supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to Common Space. I'm your host, Jamie J, along with WHYY's Elizabeth Perez Luna. And today, we're talking with the storytellers from the Common Space live event called Woke. We've got Megan Hicks, Carlos Roa, and Kitty Haley, who all shared their stories of what we're calling woke moments. Elizabeth, what would you call a woke moment?
I really think it's a little bit like being street smart, that you can't just, you know, look at your texting. You have to find out what's going on, what's the atmosphere, what's happening in the street, what are the cross currents of what people are doing. And the beauty of bringing that as an art form is that it makes you aware of all the environments, language, space. And that's what I like about what our storytellers did. They really put us in a place that we don't usually go to.
You're right. And, you know, when I think about this episode and I think about woke moments, I've reflected back on some childhood memories, and I reflected on them with this concept of being woke and being enlightened. And for example, when I recalled being a little girl in the 70s, growing up in the black section of a Delaware County town. And I used to think about it, and I would remember how all the children were outside and their parents were outside and we were all playing and having a good time. And then when I started thinking about this woke episode, I revisited that memory and I realized that a couple of the guys had guns and that the parents and the adults that were out there while we were playing carefree in the streets, they were watching vigilantly over us. Because at any moment, danger could have approached. And that, for me, was my moment of being woke, to go back to that childhood memory and be enlightened to the social injustice and the racism that was present in even this seemingly carefree moment of play as a small child. And it was really interesting to hear Megan and Carlos and Kitty all talking about the same thing, about having these experiences that brought to them realizations that they couldn't come back from.
Yeah, and you asked them, each one of them. I mean, you know, this is what Megan Hicks had to say.
Yeah, let's jump right in with Megan. Now, she's an internationally known storyteller who also hosts house concerts for storytellers. And she's a frequent performer at First Person Arts. So I began by asking Megan, who self-defines as an owl, an old white lady, what do the words stay woke mean to you?
Given the current context, I'd say it means, okay, you have an epiphany or you have a realization about social justice or injustice. And the trick now, that is a woke moment. Like, oh, whoa, my paradigm has been challenged and I see that the challenge is valid. But then life goes on and you get inured to just your dailiness, you know, and your habits and everything. And it's kind of like a little scab forms over that epiphany. And to stay woke, you kind of got to keep worrying, kind of keep stirring it and stay a little bit uncomfortable with the challenges that are coming to your assumptions.
In your story, you talk about an experience of all of a sudden understanding your circumstance as opposed to someone you thought had the same circumstances than yours.
Oh, okay. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I thought, you know, here we are, two single mothers trying to make it on one income, and we're in the same boat. And that's what I assumed until, you know, I could see that this African-American woman was not in the same boat as me, that she had a totally different set of options open to her that were much more constricted than mine.
Megan, throughout the story, you passed through some stages of being awakened. Can you talk with us about those various stages? How did you gradually wake up?
Well, I was already in a softened mood, you might say, with all my guard down when I totally dissociated from the fight that my boyfriend and I were having, that I didn't even know what the fight was about, and I was bewildered and, you know, wondering, how did I piss him off so bad? And then he stormed out, and that was sort of a little epiphany right there, that I was dating basically the same man I had always been involved with whom it had never worked out, and that nothing had changed, and it looked as though nothing was going to change. So there was like a loss of hope. And my emotions were really raw. And then when I woke up the next morning to see the cops in the front yard going back and forth between Alberta's house, and I learned that she had killed her boyfriend, you know, that was a sucker punch. But then I wanted to do that thing to get back in good graces with my boyfriend by finishing the treehouse he had started. And just the physical act of pounding those nails and doing something so physically violent and being aware of the nails shuddering every time I hit them, I totally remember that viscerally. The sweat, the ache in my arm, and just the fury, the anger that welled up, and it confused me. I didn't know what I was angry at until I got some distance from it and realized, holy shit, Alberta was in an abusive relationship, and I am too. So there were those little steps of being woke. And then when I found out that, first of all, the newspaper didn't report it because it was a TND news.
Typical N deal.
N-word deal. Typical N-word mm-hmm. deal. That just infuriated me. And then when I found out that Alberta, the judge was going to say, I'll make it all go away from you if you will go back to the blighted neighborhood you tried to get out of. If you will go back to Ohio, I can make it all go away, which means she didn't have any choices. That was kind of the process of the wokeness. And, you know, I'm still woking.
What did you like most about telling that story, that part of your life? What was it that you felt we needed to share?
The part of it that gives me butterflies in my stomach and makes my knees tremble is the fact that there was domestic abuse going on, and a woman who had no way out of it except to kill the abuser after she had exhausted her legal means, and they didn't do any good, after the restraining order didn't do any good, after a please get out of my life didn't do any good. You know, she protected herself the only way she knew how. And so here's a life gone. This man is killed. And it doesn't even make the newspaper. It doesn't even make it on a newscast because it's so common. It's typical. And that was the part I wanted to get out. And also the fact that I just realized that I didn't know it was called white privilege, but I realized that I had it and my neighbor didn't.
Mm-hmm. So when you select parts of your life that you want to tell in a story, you're not writing fiction. You're taking elements of your own life and presenting them, exposing it. What is it in the storyteller that feel that they can tell those stories to a bunch of people, that they can reveal what they're into to a degree in which it's almost painful sometimes?
There's a razor's edge there, because you don't want, as a storyteller, I do not want to do my therapy in front of an audience, you know? And I don't want my audience to worry about me. I want to tell the story from a strong place of resolution. And so, I mean, that story happened 30 years ago. And the first big public telling of it was with Woke. So that's maybe how long it took for that story to settle down and settle in, and for me to feel as though it didn't have me by the throat and that I wasn't going to lose it.
Megan, the act of telling a story, the act of selecting the story to tell, what does that process mean to you? Is it cathartic? Is it strategic? What does it mean to you?
It's making art. I got to make art. I'm an artist. So it's what I do. And it's not necessarily pulling its weight as a therapeutic thing. It's not necessarily pulling its weight as a self-esteem builder. It's just what I have to do to feel like I belong on the planet.
Why do you think that we like to listen to storytellers?
It's hardwired. It's an observable phenomenon called the storytelling trance. And you can have a whole assembly full of kids in that trance together. And from the back of the room, it doesn't look any more interactive than if they were watching TV. But from the front of the room, it's palpable. And you see that concentration, that focus, that quiet that says their imaginations are going full tilt. And each kid is creating their own universe. And that, to me, is the highest privilege of a storyteller, is to be a part of that collaborative art.
You know, stay woke is a term that has been used before throughout history, but it was recently resurrected after the shooting of Mike Brown in Ferguson, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
And stay woke became kind of a mantra for people. It was almost as if to say, we, as in African-American people, have been saying things have been happening, but nobody believed us.
Ah, yeah.
Until we got cell phones with cameras and actually captured this stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so stay woke is defined in the Urban Dictionary as staying woke to social injustice, which you were spot on when we first started talking. It was resurrected by the Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. But my question, now that you know the origin of the term, does it apply to you?
Absolutely.
Why?
Oh, because I just figured if we could level the playing field and if everybody had, you know, enough of whatever they needed, then we'd all start at square one and we'd all have an equal opportunity. And for a long time, I was mystified, you know, thinking, no, the civil rights movement, that fixed everything. That got everything all fixed. And, well, no, it didn't, as we see with, you know, with the cell phone filming and reporting and on the spot, undeniable, here's what's going on. And as you see, racial targeting and just how endemic racism is to every aspect of this American life. And it has never changed. I mean, it has permutated, but the racism, it just goes so far back. You know, I don't know if we can ever get beyond it.
Well, you know, stay woke is racial injustice, but also social injustice.
Social injustice, mm-hmm. too.
Mm-hmm. So that can affect, or does affect, everybody.
Yeah.
Thank you for taking the time to talk with us, Megan Hicks.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks a lot, Jamie.
Stay woke.
Yes, ma'am, Elizabeth.
Megan Hicks is a nationally and internationally traveled storyteller. She hosts the Rose Valley Storyteller House concerts and also teaches storytelling through the Japanese art of origami. You're listening to Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts. And it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. I'm your host, Jamie J, with Elizabeth Perez Luna. Kitty Haley is a private investigator. Kitty says she became woke while teaching public school in the city of Camden back in the 70s, when she witnessed racial and social injustice during the time of that city's worst racial strife. She wants her stories to help others to become woke.
I don't feel that the story I told expresses how I woke to any situation. I feel that this is my daily life. I am always involved in a world that other people don't understand. Television is the only way the average person understands an investigator. And so for them to hear my story, it wakens them to the reality of my life. But this is the life I lead every day. So going into a strange home, dealing with a crime, dealing with the wrongfully convicted or someone who has been abused by authority, doing civil rights work, I woke to that in the early 70s when I was a flower child marching on the streets and sitting on the sidewalk in Philadelphia and Washington and New York and wherever we needed to do that. So woke is an awareness, but my awareness came a long time ago.
Well, it's interesting because in the rehearsal room, you talked to me about two kitties.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the two different kitties that exist.
Well, I try desperately to keep my lives separate. And telling this story was very, very painful because it was real. It had just happened. I put on a suit of armor when I go to work every day. And that armor protects me from feelings that I am not allowed to have because in my job, I have to be an objective observer and I have to tell a real truth, not an alternative truth, but a fact that I see in an unbiased manner because I'm not the judge and I'm not the jury. I just collect the evidence and the information. And so I protect myself in that world by not reacting with emotion if I can avoid it and being as neutral as possible, but as fair as possible. So I observe and I listen. When I go home, I surround myself with my grandchildren. I get involved in their lives. I am the most emotional person I know. I allow myself to be vulnerable, but I can't be vulnerable on the job. So they're two different people, and bringing them together is almost painful.
In listening to what you're saying, that process that you undertake in order to move between worlds, it almost sounds like it's a process of going to sleep.
Well, I have to do it so that I can go to sleep at night. Because in the last 2 months, I've been to a funeral home where I examined a body. I've interviewed children who have been abused. I've located people who were missing intentionally and had to reveal their whereabouts. These are all things that are very painful for me. And I can't do that and go home to my life and my family and my friends who don't live that life and bring my emotions and my day with me. If I bring my day with me, I can depress the entire world. And I don't want to be depressed. I like being happy. It's really wonderful.
But do those feelings ever catch up to you?
All the time. That's why I write. Because writing is like going to a therapist. If I can clear my head and put it on paper, then I can get it out of my system and I don't have to dwell on it. I've already said it. I've put my emotions down. I've expressed them. But I don't have to actually express them to somebody. It's like a journal. I express them to myself. Recently with storytelling, I found that I can express myself by making fun of myself. Most of my stories are not as serious as the one that I told in Woke. I generally poke fun at my own foibles and my own mistakes and the situations that I get myself involved in because I have to sit on a fence that does not allow me to reveal who my client is and what my case is because of confidentiality. But the circumstances of it and the people around it are so rich with life and excitement and differences that sometimes I just have to tell about them.
So out of that richness, how do you distill what a story is going to be? Because we felt very much what it is to be a criminal investigator. You put us in the location that, you know, you were going to visit without giving us confidential information that would allow us to recognize. But there is a process in which you decide what you're going to tell and how you're going to build the story for effect and for not to have too many details. Tell me a little bit the writer's process.
It's really simple. I just remember. I remember from the minute I get out of the car. I think about the smells and the sights and the feeling of the atmosphere, the emotional reaction I have to a neighborhood. I look around and sometimes I feel the fear I felt because there's a gang on the corner and I don't know how I'm going to be received or perceived. And I garner all of my inner strength and I relive a situation that might be very painful or very exciting or maybe funny as hell. And I try to find words to put that together. I love words. Words are great. I have a very vast vocabulary, and people are always telling me that I should use more 25-cent words and less 50-cent words. But I like using 50-cent words. And when I can throw in $1.50, it even makes it more rich because I think we need to say more than sad, bad, and best in being descriptive.
Kitty, there was a moment in your story after you've come out of the house and you are sitting in your car. And you say to us, you tell us, you didn't know you were crying until a tear dropped, I guess, onto your lap. And I'd like you to tell us more about what that moment was about for you.
I think that was the transition between the working me and the human me. At that moment, I was still numb. Because I have to be numb when I go into, I don't know what I'm going to get into when I go into a house. I'm going to see dead mice. I'm going to find that the floor actually crawls and moves because there are so many cockroaches on it. I'm going to smell things I don't want to ever smell and see things I can't unsee again. And so I put the armor up in order to deal with that. When I leave that environment, there has to be a time of debriefing for me between that horrible other world that I have to report on and live because I'm really doing something good with it. And the real me that is basically a very simple lady who just likes to be happy, play some golf, have some fun, hang out with her grandkids and cook a meal for her friends. And they're so different that sometimes during that debriefing, the emotion just catches up with me because it all happens too quickly.
Well, you're not really a simple lady, so let's not oversimplify. Simple ladies don't get into being private investigators.
Who, me?
So, yeah. So what is it that took you to being an investigator?
I never intended to be an investigator. I didn't pursue it. It kind of was something that happened and my life took a turn. I was a teacher in Camden High School going back a very, very, very long time ago when we were having what we're having right now, protests against injustice. And there were marches and there were revolts. And at Camden High School in Newark, in Trenton, in all of the larger cities in New Jersey and elsewhere, unfortunately, the rioting in the school took a bad turn and there were guns and there was some violence and the police had to become involved. And it all comes down to something very simple. I fell in love with a guy who was a police officer who could not take being a police officer anymore because of the injustices in the Camden Police Department at that time. And so we started dating, and I realized that I loved the work that he was doing because we were doing civil rights work. We were helping people, and he was a black man, and it just evolved.
He was a private investigator.
He became a private investigator. He left the police department and started becoming an investigator. And when I got involved, I was doing double duty. I was teaching during the day. And at night, after my husband and his partner would go back to the office to talk about the work they did during the day, I would type up the reports and do their bookkeeping and listen. And I realized that they were two black officers with no experience in a white world, and most of their clients were white. And so when they were frustrated about how to handle a particular case, because every time they did surveillance in a white neighborhood, as two black former police officers with haircuts that made them look like former police officers and a car that made it look like a surveillance car, I took my mother's Cadillac, wore all my jewelry, went into the same neighborhood, and in 15 minutes found out everything they couldn't find out. And no one thought twice about it because I was a white woman in that neighborhood. And so it worked. And I found out you can use who you are to your advantage. And I loved it. I never turned back. I just took all my sick days and left school and started working as an investigator.
Thank you, Kitty Haley, storyteller from the Common Space episode Woke.
Thank you.
You're listening to Common Space. I'm your host, Jamie J, here in the studio with Elizabeth Perez Luna of WHYY. Now joining us is Carlos Roa. Welcome, Carlos.
Hello.
Tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am a performance artist in the city with a background in theater. I do a lot of interdisciplinary work, and I do a lot of work with performance, with writing in particular. That's how I got my start in theater, was playwriting. And yeah, I'm from Miami. I own that a lot.
So, Carlos, I'm going to say something to you, and I want you to respond with the first thing that comes to your head. Stay woke. What do you think stay woke means?
Community. I think being aware of what happens to communities that are outside of your own. So for me, that means although I am Latin, I do have to concern myself with the needs of black and brown communities across the country on a global scale. Really trying hard as best as I can to do all the emotional labor to not just make myself aware, but also to pass the mic whenever I feel like it needs to be passed, you know.
I hope you don't mind if I use that in the future.
Sure, pass, yeah.
What does pass the mic mean?
It's about not necessarily speaking on issues that pertain to other communities, but rather making sure that members of that community are given the opportunity to speak about those issues. So I think that does mean commenting on issues, for example, around Black Lives Matter, and making sure that there is a black person who actually comments on that issue and the way that it impacts them directly, rather than using the platform to say things that might not necessarily be reflective of my own experience.
The other two storytellers, their stories were very much about how they became awakened to something outside of themselves. Your story, on the other hand, was deeply personal. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. So my story was about being in a psych ward. And I look back on the experience, and I think it was one that I grew a lot from. I think there was a lot of personal development that came out of that. But at the same time, it came at the cost of really having such a miserable experience in the 2 weeks that I spent there that I don't think I was necessarily the same person coming out of there. So with regards to how personal the story is, I think this is the kind of story that I often tell people, and they're like, wow, you're so brave. And I'm like, it's not that big a deal because it happened so many years ago. And I do think to some extent I have a responsibility of sort of normalizing the experience, ending the stigma, and treating it in a very nonchalant way, because I think to do so would allow other people to speak on it themselves if they have had an experience with mental health issues. And I'll use air quotes for that.
But you did convey this kind of slow descent into disconnection, discombobulation. That was very effective. And it was very personal, too. I mean, I didn't see the collective in it, except that you had everybody listening to you and even breathing when they realized that they recognized that experience.
Yeah, I think I mean, I always encounter people who disappear and go to the hospital for a while. And nobody ever asks why they're in the hospital. Nobody ever, I don't think anybody is ever interested in figuring out why. But I am not too surprised when I hear about people going through that kind of experience. I think it happens more often than we're willing to admit. Because there is a shame about it. We don't want to acknowledge that, you know, this is something that people go through, that I think we all want to hold ourselves up on this pedestal and to present this version of ourselves that is very competent. That's the thing, too. I think there is the perception that people who have these kinds of experiences are not perceived as put together, or that they're not competent, or that they, you know, take them out of the workplace, they got to go somewhere. So I think there's just a stigma around that, right? We want to show the best version of ourselves. And then the notion of having that experience sort of contrasts with that in a very exposing way.
You know, when we talk about woke moments, mm-hmm. was this story the woke moment for you where you realized for the first time that, you know, maybe your way of thinking is not the same way of thinking of other people?
It was the first time. I mean, I think I was a weird kid growing up, but I think that might have been a different thing from what that experience was. I think it put a lot of things into context for me. I think it helped me understand that my experience was very different from other people's. And also even before that, months before that, years before that, I had been in therapy since the age of 11 or so, dealing with depression. I mean, I think at a very early age, I talked about suicide, and it was very morbid for a child. I think it was even before the age of 11 to have that relationship to mortality that shouldn't be there, that was troubling for a mother to see. So in that way, I felt like, yes, I think the lens that I saw things was very different from other people's.
But the interesting thing is that you took all that information, the process of a storyteller, to take experiences from your own life mm-hmm. and make it into a story for other people. Mm-hmm. So it's not a conversation with your therapist, not a conversation with yourself. Mm-hmm. You have to select to go through the parts of your life that you want to show, to tell what you want to say. Mm-hmm. So it's a complicated process because you have to filter and tell me about it.
Well, initially it was just it was a shorter story that I had told. And so we were sort of trying to think about ways to expand it. And what I had done a few years before I even performed this was written this long 10-page story about what actually happened to me while I was there. And so in the process of trying to extend it, I was like, oh, wait, I wrote this thing a while back. People responded very well to it. I should find a way to incorporate it because it does talk about what happens while I was there. I think when I was first approaching this performance, I thought about it less as what was happening while I was there and me telling the story of how it led up to it. I had never told that story before, and I thought of challenging myself in that way to do it. So then when it came time to really think about adding more layers, really taking people on a tour of the actual facility itself, it seemed intuitive for me to just add the old story that I had written.
There were some powerful, powerful moments that you had on stage. I'm thinking about the moment when you were writhing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what were you thinking at that moment? And how did it feel to share that with an audience member? I mean, that is a deeply, deeply personal moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, I love writhing. It is, I recommend it to everyone, even outside of the context of a psychotic episode. It feels so good to just be on the floor and writhe. So I wasn't concerned about how an audience perceived that. But I was, in that moment of when it actually happened, I mean, I just remember looking on my phone and trying to look up what's happening to me. And then the Google search responding, you're on PCP. And that was just a distinct thing that happened in that moment. I mean, it was a lot of non sequiturs that happened up here. This is me pointing at my head. And almost it happening all at once. So it's not the idea of rapid images flashing in my head, but seeing all of the images at once. Mm-hmm. Almost like sensory overload. That's a weird experience. It's hard to describe it.
Again, you know, we've said over and over again, you're writing about deeply personal material.
Mm-hmm.
But not only is it deeply personal, you wrote about something you called a psychotic episode.
Mm-hmm. Uncontrollable psychosis.
Uncontrollable psychosis.
That's what it said on the paper.
How does one capture writing that precise after having an uncontrollable episode? How did you manage that?
Well, the writing didn't actually happen until a year later. It happened when I moved to Philadelphia and I was in a place where I could write about it. I mean, the months after that, even 6 months into it, I wasn't even thinking about the experience. I was thinking about how the feeling of being damaged goods or all these thoughts like, oh, I'm never going to find anybody who would want to be with me after knowing if they find out what I've gone through. Feeling dirty, I think, was more what I was focusing on in the months after the hospitalization. So it took me a whole year, I would say, probably longer, a little bit longer, for me to actually be able to write about it. And to write about it with a detachment, to now know that this has no power over me anymore, it had to take time.
You mentioned that for a time you felt dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Do you still have those feelings? And if not, when did they pass away?
Yeah, I don't think it's about feeling dirty anymore at this point. I think it's about just knowing that if you play that Sesame Street game, one of these things is not like the other. I'm always going to be one of these things. And in some ways, it's about finding ways to see that as an empowering thing, rather than something that holds you back. So what I've done is sort of, I mean, it's something I always think about now. Like, I just don't think like you anymore. I don't think like them. And I think acknowledging that to me has sort of freed me to be confident about talking about it and just to not see it as a problem anymore. I don't think of it as a problem. I don't think I'm dirty. I think more often than not, a lot of people have had this experience and are just not willing to share it and are afraid to share it, or they try to cover it up and like, oh, I just had a bad stomach ache, when really they were in the psychiatric unit.
So what were the positive things that you experienced as a result of openly sharing your story?
I think it makes me feel like I have a role in the art world. I think it's validated me as an artist. I'm reluctant to buy into the tortured artist caricature or stereotype, because that's not always true. But I think to some extent, to be an artist, you do have to sort of live life on the edge, or to see things in a very different way from the people around you. So having that experience really has made me more confident as an artist, and even made me more confident in talking about my art, in knowing that my art should exist.
Carlos Roa is a performance artist and writer from Miami, now based in Philadelphia. You've been listening to Common Space, a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY. It's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. Common Space includes a monthly broadcast and podcasts available on iTunes and Stitcher. Please subscribe, and while you're listening, give us a rating. I'm Jamie Brunson, host and co-writer of Common Space. Elizabeth Perez Luna is the executive producer of Common Space and co-writer. Our Common Space team members are producer Mike Villers, Dan Gashevsky, Jen Cleary, and Ali L'Esperance. Our studio engineer is Diana Martinez. Our archivist is Neil Barden. Thank you so much for listening.